Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm delighted to welcome back Professor Nick Crossley, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Manchester, to talk about connecting sounds, the social life of music. So welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
So I don't know if I'd call this a sort of a sequel, but it follows on from your last book, which was a book about punk using a kind of social network analysis, relational sociology perspective. And I guess this book tries to set a broader agenda about relational sociology and also shows the benefits of social network analysis. And that's the place to start, really, is if you could tell me, I guess, what this kind of understanding of the world is, this relational perspective, and you know, how that's driven you to write the book.
So relational sociology is my way of trying to stress the importance of interaction, relationships, and networks as the fundamental underlying concepts for sociology. And I suppose if I was going to make the case briefly, I would contrast that with a kind of an individualism on the one hand, which will say the basic units of the social world are individual people, or a holism on the other hand of the sort of functionalist and to some extent Marxist kind, where you have a notion of an all-encompassing whole, which has its own logic and of development and its own needs and capacity to fulfill those needs. And relational sociology is trying to come somewhere in between that and say, well, there's no point in talking about individuals as independent and self-sufficient beings. We can only exist in relationship to and interaction with other people. But at the same time, we keep that sense of agency and we keep that dynamism and we don't defer to a higher level concept such as society or social society in that functionalist or history in that kind of Marxist sense. But we do have a sense of structure, and that sense of structure is the network. That's what gives this sense of, well, a society is a network with multiple relations and interactions going on in it of all different kinds. And in the punk book, I had tried to look at the emergence of punk in those terms. So to look at the networks of people who were responsible for making punk, in the innovation of punk in the mid-1970s. But in a sense, that book, really, insofar as a relational perspective was concerned, it really only focused on the networks. And what I wanted to do in this book was to try to step back from that and to say, okay, so networks are important, and I'm going to say more about networks, and I'm going to say more about why they're important and how we should think about them and all the rest of it. But I also want to step back from the networks and look at the other aspects of a relational sociology that I wasn't able to talk about in that first book, and also to think about them more in the abstract, to think about them in a more general theoretical way rather than being tied to any specific empirical example.
I mean, it sort of struck me as well, and this, you know, I might have misread it, but one of the kind of classic critiques of a sociological perspective on any kind of aesthetic form is, yeah, but, you know, you've not told us about the music, the art, you've not told us about the drama or whatever. And it struck me that in this book, you're trying to kind of respond into that a bit. And you bring in this kind of definition of music, this conception of musicking, this new term that you use. And I'm interested in how you sort of use this relational approach to, I suppose, pay more attention to the aesthetic form.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. I mean, there's a twofold challenge going on. On the one hand, there is a challenge to the tendency for sociology simply to explore the context of music and not to engage with the form itself. But there's also a challenge to musicology. And it's not, in fairness, not really my challenge so much as a challenge that I've picked up on and run with that various musicologists have posited, to the idea of music as, say, for example, a text in a narrow sense, or music as an object, music as a thing. And what these musicologists have suggested is that we think of music as an activity. We think of music as something that is done. And what I've tried to do is to expand on and develop that by saying, well, it's an interactivity. Music is something that happens between us. I mean, I suppose the limit case being the interaction between the maker of sounds and the hearer of those sounds, which in the absolute limit case might be the same person, but is still an interaction. And so I've then tried to work with that to think of the music itself as activity, as social interaction. And because it's social interaction, it's therefore something that sociologists can engage with and have something meaningful to say about, not something that we need to step back to simply to defer to musicologists. I mean, obviously, we have to defer to musicologists in some respects and for some purposes, but we can engage with music itself, the music in itself. And I suppose ethnomusicologists show us that to some extent, that there are some musical forms that absolutely you can only make sense of them as ongoing interactions. But I think it's true of all music, you know, even when we go home and we plug the headphones in and we listen to a bit, there's still an interaction going on there. And it never happens without interaction.
Yeah, I mean, music as an interaction, as an activity, as a doing, as, you know, something that has an inherently sort of social element, even if that's a very, you know, kind of closed and individualized social element, raises the kind of, I suppose, the obvious idea of, like, music having a world attached to it. And obviously, like, art world is a really famous kind of idea from Becker's work, you know, that kind of like social perspective on the production of the aesthetics. And I was struck, not that you, you know, kind of said, oh yeah, and we can have music worlds as well, but the way you were trying to use that idea to tell, I suppose, to map maybe, or tell the story of how people would understand particular kinds of things like genres.
Yeah,
and the obvious way that, you know, it struck me to kind of ask you about what a music world is to ask, so what's like mainstream music, and what, you know, what are alternatives to it? Because I was quite struck by the way you didn't just kind of say music is a social activity, there is a doing, but you were keen to do a kind of, well, there's a political economy going on, you know, there's an industry, you know, all of these things are sort of interrelated to give us a sense of something as, I guess, as normal as calling something mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, the mainstream is an interesting one, and I suppose in some ways it was a bit of a challenge. I mean, I think music worlds are quite easy to think about when you think about obscure or alternative music worlds, because we can all recognize that there's a particular community of people, they're all connected to one another, they form a network, and they are distinguished by the particular sorts of events that they go to, maybe the way they dress, and certainly the kinds of music that they listen to and the way that they talk about those types of music. So the alternatives are in some senses conspicuous and obvious. The mainstream was a little bit more difficult, some writers in the field have just dismissed the idea of a mainstream altogether. But I suppose, I mean, and again, just condensing a huge amount into a few words. One of the things that struck me is the way that people talk about breaking into the mainstream. And I think that metaphor of breaking into the mainstream suggests that you have got a bounded entity, a relatively closed entity, and an entity which musicians who aren't a part of it certainly experience as a reality and as something that they're unable to break into. And so then from that idea, I mean, again, thinking of networks, I was thinking of, well, who occupies those dominant positions within the charts? Who headlines the main festivals or plays on the main stages of the main festivals? Who do we see in the newspapers, in the magazines, who do we hear on the radio, who's interviewed on the television, and so on? And I think, I mean, it's clear that you've got all of those different sites, and those different sites are linked by the fact that you've got the same people moving between them. And so this then starts to give me an idea of a network and of a mainstream world, which is indeed very difficult to break into, because it's very difficult to sell huge amounts of your music, or to occupy, to sell huge amounts of your recordings if you're not headlining the big festivals and playing at the big arenas. It's difficult if you're not being covered in the daily newspapers and on magazines and getting radio airplay. But equally, you're not going to get radio airplay unless you are selling huge numbers of records. So you've got these kind of vicious circles. And I think it's these vicious circles between all of these markers of mainstream success, which constitute the world. They constitute that network, and they generate a boundary around and outside of that network. So then it seems to me that it does become entirely meaningful in the way that I talk about it to think of a mainstream music world. And I suppose as well, you know, colloquially, that just figures in our sense that all these superstar musicians know one another because they're going to the same parties. They're appearing on the same stages and so on. And it kind of creates a bit of a club. It creates a network or a world. And so that's the mainstream, which, like I say, I thought was a bit more difficult maybe to think about than the smaller alternative worlds. But they're exactly the same. You know, free jazz improvisation is a world, folk is a world, metal is a world, and so on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, it sort of struck me that, like, that's exactly what you'd expect a relational social network kind of take on understanding music to say. But that's really just one element of the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I liked, those things that are great about the book, but one of the things I liked about the book was you kind of set out the theoretical approach, illustrate this really straightforwardly with the musical world's idea, and again, you know, with reactions to the mainstream, selling out ideas, you know, all the kind of stuff you'd almost kind of expect. But actually, much of the book is about meaning, which is something that, you know, if people are familiar with social network analysis, for example, is one of the things that is often stripped out. You know, if you look at a network diagram, you can understand relationships, you can understand how, you know, power works, how inequality functions. But then, you know, the sense of, like, well, why does this matter? What does this mean? You know, it is often not there. And, you know, certainly almost half of the book, you know, perhaps more, is taken up with this question about meaning. And there's really, you know, straightforward, question to raise about that. Like, where is meaning in this kind of analysis? And I suppose, like, why were you so interested to write so much about meaning, both in terms of the music and in terms of people's lives as well?
Where to start with that one? I suppose in part there was a recognition that one of the things that I really hadn't said much about in the punk book, in the earlier book, was meaning. That, and I felt that to be a bit of an omission. And I felt that there may well be people who would read that book and say, well, that's great, but what did punk mean? What was it all about? So I partly wanted to address that, I think. Partly, I suppose, there's a biographical element that music has just been my life and identity ever since I was about 10, you know, 9 or 10. And so I think when it is so central to your own life, you kind of have an obligation to recognise that it is the kind of thing that can be so important and so central to people's lives, and to acknowledge that. And I think I was also interested. There were two things really that came from the literature. I mean, one was this curious this curious thing that I think you still find to some extent in aspects of musicology and of philosophical aesthetics, where it's still a question: is music meaningful? Does music have any meaning, or does it have any external meaning, at least? And it struck me as a kind of, an outrageous question, really, that anybody could think that you would ever answer no to that. And yet, of course, at the same time, when it comes to it, it's quite difficult to pin down, well, you know, how and in what way, and what does it mean to say that music has meaning? So I just got intellectually drawn into that and thought, oh, I've got to give an answer to this. I've got to say why it is. And And then I suppose just also when meaning is recognized in both in sociology and cultural studies and musicology to some extent, the tendency to want to pin that on the text. I mean, very often also to pin it onto lyrics. My thought was, well, that's not the relational answer, because music, we're saying that music is interaction, so therefore the meaning of music must come about in interaction. And I wanted to try to consider some of the ways in which that's true, some of the ways in which we can identify that. And I think that needs to be there in the relational perspective, because otherwise the relational perspective does just become a fairly dry mathematical thing. It lends itself maybe to an economic analysis of exchange of resources and all the rest of it. But you've got to show that what's going on in these networks is the generation of meaning. And to some extent, that's why they matter. That's why they're important, because they generate meaning.
I mean, how does that work for people, and, you know, a sense of identity or a sense of self?
So part of what I try to look at is the kind of, you know, how particular musical figures might take on meaning for people. It's kind of a semiotic analysis of that. But another dimension of this is about what is engaging with current debates about uses of music and what we use music for. And the answer that comes, I suppose, from the literature and in relationship to my own self-analysis and in relationship to talking to students is that music, we often use music as a way of building identity and of our identity work. And that can occur in lots of different kinds of ways. I mean, so there's this sort of obvious thing about what we like or what we say we like marking out our status and positioning us in relationship to other people. So I like really cool, hip, esoteric music that the masses have never heard of. And so there's that dimension. But we can also then go beyond that, I think, to sort of say, well, you know, I think sometimes music is involved in people's identities because it provides a context wherein which they can think about their own life and their own biography, and they might think about issues that are going on in their own world. You know, the kind of somehow a song manages to encapsulate for people a feeling that they're struggling to articulate, or maybe a song, the message of a song seems to answer the questions that people are asking in their existential their existential moments. So that's another dimension, the sense that, you know, I'm sure many people listen to and obsess about Morrissey because Morrissey understands them. You know, Morrissey understands the existential misery that they're going through that nobody else does.
I mean, less so nowadays.
Less so nowadays. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm sure my age is as well. But then there's also the idea of how we might use music to manage our emotional states, which I think is also again a part of identity work. So I'm really going to show my age again now, but before I used to go to an exam, you know, I would listen to The Clash at full kind of volume, and it gave me that empowering sense of, right, okay, you know, if Joe Strummer's going to take on the world, I can at least manage, you know, a sociology exam or whatever it might be. So there's that. And I came across a lot of references in the literature to the cathartic sense that people have, that their frustrations and their anger and all the rest of it are things that they can work through simply by riding the song, you know, following the song through. And venting is a word that comes up quite a lot in the literature. People venting their feelings by, you know, whatever it is, playing air guitar, dancing, moshing, or just pretending to be the artist, that kind of identification with the artist, you know, or alternatively, music might be the way in which we get ourselves ready for a Friday night. You know, music is kind of that, playing the music that we're going to be listening to puts us in the party mood, gets us ready to go out, or brings us down again. Music, if we need to relax, what do? Well, sometimes we just listen to calming, relaxing music. And so all of those different ways in which music allows us to manage our own emotional states, I think, is another facet, another dimension of identity work. I suppose once I first started to read that stuff, it just seemed so true because it was describing me. And I thought, well, you know, and it's part of those, the interactions that I'm talking about. That those, so when we're doing music, we are we're doing lots of other things as well. You know, doing music, we can be doing economic activity, doing political activity, doing identity work. I refer to it in the book as multivalence. You know, the idea that the same interaction might be fulfilling multiple ends all simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, all of the examples you've given there, I think are really powerful and connect to how people sort of use music and, you know, kind of experience the world through music. But, you know, they're sort of on an individual level. And the way the book turns from that is to think about, well, actually music is productive in lots of other ways. And there's a discussion of both politics towards the end of the book, but also an engagement with the idea that music can be productive of the sense of a public sphere. As well. And I was really struck by that because, you know, usually we think of public spheres often through kind of media scholarship, whether it's, you know, analysis of the news or whether it's things like, you know, kind of shared social movements, stuff like this. And it's, you know, it's comparatively rare that, unless, you know, I totally misunderstand the literature, that you'd get something like, well, actually music produces public spheres as much as the news does, or, you know, particular social movements do. And I'm interested to hear more about that, actually, because it moves us really kind of concretely from that individual sense of meaning back, I think, to, you know, the level of the social.
Yeah, well, I think, I was cautious in the book in how I approached the relationship between music and the public sphere. Because clearly, I mean, I suppose my source for the public sphere is Habermas, and you kind of have this idea of rational deliberation. And obviously music in many respects is very far removed from those kinds of things. But it seemed to me on the one hand that music can be, well, music can be a provocation for thinking about these various kinds of things. And it's a provocation which sometimes gets in behind the defences, I suppose, that rational debate might erect against it. So, you know, you can hear any number of politicians and activists talking about trying to persuade you of a particular political cause. And be relatively unmoved by that, and yet a song which just engages your imagination, it just captures, so might then force you to think about it, and it might create an empathy which forces you and makes you feel obliged to engage with a particular kind of issue. And it seems to me that is quite important, and it gives maybe groups who are excluded and who want to make a claim in the public sphere, it helps to bring them into the public sphere. I mean, I think of I think of a song, I'm trying to, like Strange Fruit, which, so for me, the in particular, the Nina Simone version of Strange Fruit. And, you know, I mean, in a sense, it forces it creates the sadness and the sorrow in the song kind of gives you a sense of what the community on the receiving end of the lynching in the American South. I mean, obviously, I'm not suggesting for a minute that you know what it's like or that you feel, but you at least get a glimpse of that. And that is in a sense more powerful than somebody just telling you about it. That kind of draws you in. So there's that dimension. There's that way in which I think music is able to provoke reflection and debate and thought. And it's not a substitute for it, but it might be a stimulus that makes us feel compelled then to engage and talk about issues that we might not otherwise feel compelled or to talk about. And then I suppose that there are, I mean, in my experience, music has always had that dimension of political engagement with it. It seems to me that sometimes the collective identities that form around particular types of music are often also political identities. So there's a sense maybe of that certain alternative music worlds also stand for alternative political causes or oppositional political causes of one sort or another. And you get a flavour of that at gigs, and you get even more of a flavour of that maybe at festivals. And so these things, again, are being talked about. They're being talked about in the gig, in the space of the gig, by people, and people feeling, just because of their collective identity, because of their collective attachment to a particular music world, they then maybe again feel the inclination, the need to talk about the political issues that go along with that. I mean, I think it's interesting because I think Brexit has been problematic in that respect. I mean, my maybe slightly cynical take on it is that artists aren't entirely sure which way their audiences go on it, and so they've been reluctant to talk about it. But then occasionally in some sorts of gigs and some sorts of context, it becomes a discussion. The artist does talk about it, and it becomes a focus and something that people do start to talk about and maybe do start to build into their own identity. And then, I mean, there are more straightforward cases. I mean, there have been a number of writers who've written about hip hop and rap as a sort of context where excluded groups, in this case African Americans, are denied access to many of the sorts of outlets that you were talking about earlier. They perhaps feel that the political parties don't represent them. They perhaps feel that the mass circulation media don't represent them and represent their view. And so a music world becomes a space in which their views can be articulated. I mean, again, not that anybody is simply going to hear a particular rapper say something and then agree with it anything like that, but there's a provocation there, and there's an expression perhaps of views and a public expression that gives legitimacy perhaps to views which certain groups in society feel are their issues that don't get talked about in any other kind of context. So it's a bit garbled, but I hope I covered the bases.
I mean, there's loads more we could have talked about in the book. We've mainly, understandably, been talking about music, but also the book, you know, is a theoretical engagement with Bourdieu, with Adorno, you know, as well as with people like Becker, and then, you know, the kind of broader relational sociology tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems, I think I mentioned early on, you know, this is a bit of a sort of agenda setting book, and it seems almost kind of strange if you've written an agenda setting book to say, so what are you going to do next then? But yeah, you know, what I guess, you know, what comes after something like this, back to a more detailed case study approach perhaps, or, you know, is it time to stop writing about music? What are you thinking of now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering about that's a question that I'm thinking about myself at the moment. I mean, I have one or two ideas for some of the kind of returning to some of the theoretical questions, which are slightly divorced from the music, but some of the theoretical questions relating to relational sociology that, in a sense, were the book helped me to think through and got me to a point with, but now I perhaps want to step back and have address some of those and have a go at some of those. But I certainly intend to carry on with the, you know, with the music. At the moment, I'm desperately trying to resist the temptation just to kind of repeat something that I did in relationship to punk, in relationship to some other music world. I mean, that would be, well, I say it would be easy. I mean, it wouldn't be easy, because there's lots of difficulties involved in actually trying to get to do it. But there's a temptation there to think, oh, I wonder if I could do it for, and you know, then add your own genre in there. But I certainly do want to take the music, the relational analysis of music further, and to pick up on some of the threads within the book, but I do want to do them empirically, and that to some extent depends upon me finding an interesting empirical example, finding something that I want to spend a bit of time looking at and thinking about and researching. And I suppose it will then also depend on when I find that empirical example that I want to work with, also then having to think about which of the issues that I talk about in the book I can address by those means. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the meaning, and I would love to do something empirical which explored some of that in more detail. But at the moment, I can only think of really crappy ways of doing it. So who knows? If I think of a good way, of what I think of as a good way of doing it, that would be interesting, then I would do something like that. But yeah, there's going to be more music to come, but I'm not quite sure what it is yet.